Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey guys, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl for Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Today, you are going to get all the information and info that you want to know about when it comes to fertility. We talked to the amazing Dr. Ruhi Jalani with Kind Body Fertility. She is a double board certified OBGYN in REI, reproductive endocrinology and infertility, as well as obstetrics and gynecology. She speaks around the world on this topic, and she has amazing social media platforms where she is very candid about her own journey, as well as issues around fertility and management. We had a great discussion. We talked about the current climate of fertility in the United States. We spoke about the politics and how it's impacting fertility. We talked about PCOS, and you're going to learn about management techniques and what it is and why it's important to understand your menstrual health. And then we just also just talked a little bit about egg freezing and all that stuff. So I can't wait for you guys to listen to this. Please stay tuned for Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones with Dr. Ruhi Jalani. I'm super excited today to have you guys with me on another podcast of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Today, I have my good friend and colleague that's joining us, and we're going to talk about fertility and PCOS and all your questions that you may have around that. It's Dr. Ruhi Jalani. She is an amazing, amazing, amazing reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist, double board certified in OBGYN and that REI as well. She practices in Chicago currently and works under Kind Body, which is a nationally run organization. Yeah. So she works and hones her skills in fertility, but she also is a huge, huge patient advocate. I'm sure many of you know her from her Instagram and her social media platforms, which are probably, upwards of like probably close to a million people following her at any given time on any platform. And, she speaks openly about, her own journeys and is really, I find, we collaborate a lot. We send each other patients in Chicago a lot. And I always tell my patients, like, if anyone will give you hope, it's Dr. Jalani. So I want to send you to her. So,
thank you.
A lot of people in the fertility world. So thank you, Dr. Jalani. Oh, and your full bio will be in the show notes. So, and how to get in touch with her.
Thank you so much. Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for that very kind introduction. And thank you so much for having me. And I'm honored to be on here. And I think it's so important what you do. I know I personally, just having been impacted by fertility and having gone through all these treatments, and also just culturally not openly talking about sex, intercourse, vaginismus, pelvic pain, anything related to sex and periods, I'm a huge advocate for you. I send you truly all my patients because I think you do such an important job and a service that we're really missing.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you as well. Well, let's get into it. Let's talk about, the fertility world and what's happening. First of all, I want to really get into PCOS a little bit too, but obviously what's pressing most people right now is like all the legislation around, controlling women's bodies, abortion, all of that stuff. And it's actually rolled over into your realm, fertility and what it means and what's going on. Like, how are you guys handling this? I mean, I know we're in Chicago, so we're kind of like in a bubble.
Yeah.
But there's so many states in this country that have really restricted, healthcare for women. Abortion is healthcare, fertility is healthcare. And, what can be done with, these, embryos that are frozen and all of that. So let's talk about like how you've dealt with it. I know you've been advocating for it a lot.
For sure. I'm a part of Doctors for Fertility, which initially was formed when they reversed Roe v. Wade, mm-hmm. and that reproductive rights can now then be determined by state. And when we first started saying, well, this will impact fertility, no one understood how and why. And to be very candid, I didn't either. I was like, well, I get it, but I don't get it. Like, it's super upsetting that happened. But slowly, as you start learning, because they started trying to control, well, when can you get an abortion? What is an abortion? What's termination? And slowly, they started saying, well, life begins at fertilization. And fertilization, if you know IVF, happens at the egg retrieval. What you truly don't know is not all eggs that fertilize actually become an embryo. Not all embryos are normal, and not all embryos implant. And not to get too personal, but with me, it was a really good example of how many perfect embryos it took to help me build my family. It's insanity. So when you hear these laws, or when you hear this type of legislation being put into place by people who don't quite understand the science behind it, it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. But it also then starts to limit what you can do and where you can receive care and what type of care. And there's actually clinics that have shut down because of legislation like this due to fear of not wanting to get prosecuted.
Right. And I think that's a big concern for clinicians, not being able to provide the care that we want to, but also being prosecuted for providing the care, like being put into jail for doing a life-saving ectopic pregnant surgery or all the things around IVF that you guys do, which is very frustrating. And you know, other than understanding who we elect and just advocating for yourself, I mean, what other advice would you give the listeners about that?
Support PACs and support candidates. Your voice matters. Truly, I'm coming from a place of like, I don't mix politics with medicine, with my career, with my this. But now if you don't do it, someone's speaking on your behalf. So this is your chance. Like you said, vote for the right candidate, really understand what they stand for. Like, this can make and break the future of reproductive rights and healthcare and other people meddling who don't quite understand what you're going through.
Right. Well, I just wanted to touch base on that because you're my first fertility specialist I've had on. So I wanted to get your opinion.
I'm honored.
I really want to do a deeper dive into something that we all know. I mean, I think that you and I treat in our offices a lot, and we both have, you know, a good number of South Asian followers, and we know it impacts South Asians more as well. And so I wanted just to elucidate some issues around fertility and what is, you know, polycystic ovarian syndrome, treatments around it, all the things that you always talk about in terms of like supplements that might help and all of these things. So I guess we should start, like, you can describe how you talk to your patients about PCOS and what is it, and how do you talk to them about it?
Yeah. So PCOS is polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's actually a misnomer because every time I say that, the first thing I get is, well, I don't have cysts. So it's actually not cysts, but it's a lot of follicles or eggs on your ultrasound. So it actually comes across as a high ovarian reserve. So when you get scanned or when you do blood work, everything looks perfect and your egg count looks very high. We're going to talk about a little bit of the differential diagnosis, but most people also don't find out they have PCOS until they're actually trying to conceive. So believe it or not, even if you didn't know in the past and you find out when you're actually trying to get pregnant, that is typically when most people find out. Mm-hmm. In order to be diagnosed with PCOS, you need two out of the three, and they're really vague diagnoses. But you need to have multifollicular ovaries, meaning greater than 12 eggs on one or both ovary, biochemical or clinical signs of hyperandrogenism, meaning acne and male pattern hair growth, right? I'm South Asian, so whenever I'd go around and be like, oh, I'm hairy, and they'd be like, of course you're hairy, you're brown. Yeah. Right. So it's male pattern hairiness.
You're 12 or something.
Yeah. So you want to make sure you're looking at male pattern hair growth, right? Hair on your knuckles, hair on your toes, hair on your chin. And
around the nipple.
But it's more of a male pattern hair growth. That's important to differentiate. And then the third one is irregular cycles or periods greater than 35 days apart. This I learned as a doctor to ask, because I remember I asked, are your periods regular? And they're like, yeah. So I was like, okay, well, have you come in with your next bleed? They're like, well, it's like in 2 months. And I'm like, wait, that's not regular, but that's regular for them. So it's important to ask, like, greater than 35 days apart is another sign. So if you have two out of the three, and you may not, right? There's a PCOS syndrome, that's the whole syndrome. And then there's a PCO phenotype where you have the ovarian appearance of PCOS, but maybe not necessarily the rest of it. And you still, when it comes to fertility, I treat these patients like a PCOS variant.
Yeah. And I think it's important to understand people always ask, oh, can I get rid of it? It is what we consider like a genetic predisposition, right? I think that that is something, you know, in a perfect storm of environmental factors, you might manifest some of those. But, and you're right, that's to your point that some people don't find out till they have fertility problems because they don't realize that this little, you know, hair here and there that they've developed or their cycles have always been 35 to 40 days. So it doesn't seem like a big deal, you know, and they don't find out until they're not able to get pregnant or having challenges around it. But I think that, you know, that's something I always emphasize to patients is that it's not something that you'll necessarily get rid of, but you can control with different techniques, whether it's diet, exercise modification, you know, medications and all that.
Yeah, for sure. I was misdiagnosed and I was diagnosed correctly when I was younger, but then when I was trying to conceive, after I kept failing letrozole and Clomid, the REs were like, well, you were misdiagnosed. You're actually not PCOS because you don't look like a PCOS. And then I'd get so frustrated because my whole life here, I thought I was PCOS and I am, but it's just not all PCOS look the same. They don't present the same way, but it's definitely something important to know that, especially South Asian PCOS, I'm very lean. I don't look like a typical PCOS. I don't have that cystic acne. So it's so easy, especially being treated in Detroit where it's majority African Americans and their PCOS presents so differently. So it's constantly like, well, you don't look like this PCOS patient, so you must not have it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to the point of South Asians, you know, I think the statistic is we're like a quarter of the world population, but like 67% of the world, diabetes, heart disease, all of that stuff. So we carry a heavy burden of metabolic dysfunction. And, and you know, most of us know somebody that had a heart attack and died before the age of 50. So I think we carry such a load of metabolic dysfunction that I think that's why I think it's like 1 in 4, I think, in South Asian PCOS. And to your point, it doesn't always mean that, you know, the classic stereotype that we probably learned way back in the day when PCOS was really, you know, initially talked about as sort of someone that suffers from obesity and they have, you know, facial hair, they might have, you know, this acanthosis in the back of their neck, they might have, you know, facial hair, hair loss, maybe male pattern balding, but it's really that phenotype that people still assume is, and so I oftentimes will have doctors dispute me on a patient that I'm pretty sure that I think has PCOS because they meet the criteria, but they're super thin like you.
Yeah.
No, can't be the case.
No, 100%. Like PCOS presents really differently, especially in South Asians. And it's super important to actually understand the diagnostic criteria to know when to advocate for yourself. Cause I had to do that. And it was sad because I was a patient and doctor, and then I already had the diagnosis, but then was constantly being told I didn't fit that because I kept failing what worked. And not all PCOS present the same, and not all of them will respond the same, and not all of them will get pregnant the same. So just because you have PCOS doesn't mean you may not need fertility treatment. And then in my head, also this kind of really messed with my head because I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to take letrozole and it'll work because that's the only problem that I need to restore ovulation. But you're right, like exactly what you said, there's a whole syndrome associated where there's a metabolic component, there's a health, there's a lifestyle, there's so many factors that go into it.
Right, exactly. And I think that's where some patients get, you know, this delayed diagnosis, or, you know, they may not, you know, even be told about it for the longest time. And, you know, there's a high, you know, it's Mental Health Awareness Month right now in May. I don't know when this is going to air, but, you know, there's a huge burden of depression and anxiety among PCOS patients as well because of, I think, all the factors associated with it. And so I think it's important to really look at each individual as a whole, right? And what they're experiencing.
Yeah.
They're going. So do you ever see like the blood level that you're talking about that's elevated a lot of times at PCOS is the anti-Müllerian hormone. Do you ever see patients have that really low AMH and then they have anything, but they still have?
There was a paper that showed accelerated ovarian aging in PCOS patients. PCOS is really hard to diagnose as we get older. Typically, they present with a high AMH because their egg count is so high, and that's one of the diagnostic criteria. But if you're older and then you present to a fertility doctor, sometimes it can be harder to diagnose PCOS because your egg count may not necessarily be as high. And it's not necessarily diminished reserve unless they've had intervention. And in Europe and in India and South Asia, they actually still do ovarian drilling where they try to get rid of a lot of the eggs on the surface to restore ovulation. So in those patients, sometimes you do see a lower reserve, but not naturally. Oh. You know, you shouldn't see the natural decline.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about, you know, how you go about, you know, counseling these patients about their fertility and, you know, sort of, well, let's talk about fertility testing for a second, because, you know, I often get patients come in like they're 28, 30, or maybe 33 years old. And I just want to get my fertility checked because I need to know if I should get going right away, or if I should, like, I'm okay to wait a while. Like, what, I mean, I can tell you my spiel, but I want to hear what your spiel is when you meet patients. I mean, obviously I don't do fertility treatments in my office, but I get a lot of patients that ask me about fertility treatment and evaluation.
Well, I really do appreciate what you do. I think you tee them up perfectly for me. And I think that's important also, how they segue from their gynecologist to a fertility doctor, because fertility is scary. And I think you do such a good job of preparing them and transitioning them to me. That's one of the things in my journey. It was, you fail, now you have to go to the doctor, without really understanding, like, what's my workup? What's different? What can they do? What can you do? And I think as a provider, the gynecologist, like, you are my go-to, right? Like, as patient, like, I trust you, I go to you, I don't want to leave you. So I think that was important. And I think I'm super grateful that you do that, because your patients are mentally prepared, because it is mentally and emotionally tolling. My spiel is, if you had unprotected intercourse under 35 for a year and you're not pregnant, that means you fall in that subfertility category. And it's important to differentiate, because a lot of my patients always start with, well, we weren't really trying, right? And I always say, well, what does that mean to you? And they're like, oh, well, we didn't really use tests, and I didn't, you know, use ovulation predictor kits and blah, blah, blah. And I have to undo that and say, well, that's actually trying, when even though you're not trying, because without trying, if you're not using any barrier, withdrawal, or anything, 80% of couples after 1 year of unprotected intercourse should be pregnant. So that's one. If you're over 35, it's 6 months, not because your fertility drops, but because your quality drops. So your take-home baby rate after 35 drops, so you want to be quicker to start seeking treatment or intervention. And at 40, you want to seek care even before you start trying, because most of your eggs will be abnormal than normal. So if you're 40 and you're thinking about building a family or starting a family, seek out help. You don't have to stop trying to seek out help. You can do both tandemly. And if you're pregnant, wonderful. That's what we want. But if you're not pregnant, at least you're teed up to get going.
And what do you tell them about, you know, the blood test that they'll come bring you? Like, oh, I did an at-home AMH, or, you know, an at-home FSH on day three or whatever, or my doctor did this and she said it was fine. So I figured, like, my fertility was fine. You know, I always tell patients a snapshot in time, and, you know, it's like, really, I always talk about how you guys use it in fertility land, right? Like, it's used to see how you might respond to these medications. But I'd like to hear
you're 100% right. It's an assessment of the now, your time step of the now. It doesn't indicate whether you're fertile or infertile. It helps us gauge your quantity and your quality in that moment. Remember, 1/3 of infertility is unexplained. So you could have perfectly normal egg sperm tubes and you can still be infertile, because there's an underlying physiology or pathology that we don't quite understand. So just because they're good doesn't mean they're actually good. These are just markers of, if we were to do IVF or egg freezing or treatment, what do these numbers help us gauge treatment options?
Well, let's go back to the PCOS question and how, you know, how you guide patients in PCOS. Do you, you know, there's all the questions about, you know, should I be on metformin? Should I use inositol? Should I, you know, what should I be doing to optimize for my fertility? I'm only 25, but I want to get pregnant when I'm, you know, 28, that kind of stuff. Like, what do you tell patients, you know, how to optimize their fertility when they have PCOS, and what may you use when you're actually treating them?
Yeah. So to optimize your fertility, you want to look at your body as a whole. So lifestyle, Mediterranean diet's the best for fertility. PCOS, you want to be lower on the glycemic index, not complete keto, but something that's manageable, sustainable, long-term. So low processed food, more fruits, more vegetables, more lean meats, adding in omegas. That's the most sustainable, kind of like a well-rounded diet for PCOS. Mm-hmm. I'm a good believer in supplements. I know not everyone is, but I added in something called inositol. Inositol really helps with equality. It works through an insulin mechanism, so it's an insulin sensitizer. And a lot of PCOS patients tend to have insulin resistance, which the short way to test for it is hemoglobin A1C. So we say, well, if your A1C is fine, you may not have it, but that's actually not true. The true way to check it is to check your response to glucose. So you're supposed to actually do a 75 gram glucose load and check your fasting insulin to post-load ratio and then treat with metformin, because it takes such a long time to do and most REs or even endocrinologists don't do it. We use hemoglobin A1C as a surrogate marker or your overall health.
And so you tell them, and then so what diet you talked about, maybe, and obviously incorporating exercise and that capacity. And inositol, where do you fall on with metformin? You will start it on patients with, obviously I started on most of my PCOS patients if they are struggling with visceral fat or, you know, especially if their hemoglobin A1C is elevated. And is that kind of your way of treating that stuff?
Definitely. I try to do it with, like, PCOS tend to have a central obesity issue. Like, even me, even though I'm really lean, it takes me so much of my diet, like clean eating and working out, to manage my blood sugar levels, to manage my cholesterol levels. So there's this huge metabolic component to it. So I'm a big advocate for metformin.
And of course, I have to. We have to talk a little bit about the GLP-1 agonist.
Yes,
I a few years ago, actually, I started studying these obesity medications, like before the craze happened, because I had been reading about them, and so I would have these patients on metformin that were PCOS that would fail metformin. They weren't losing weight, and it was interesting because back then that they could get on Ozempic, like the patient's insurance covered their Ozempic because they had failed metformin. So it's like you had PCOS, you failed metformin, you weren't a diabetic, you could get these medications and they responded so well, like it was amazing. And then, of course, when, you know, the stock and supply has been diminished and, you know, everyone's trying to use these medications now because they are great drugs, the PCOS patients, if they're not, you know, in the category of obesity, which a lot of my patients weren't anymore because they had been using the Ozempic, so they weren't obese anymore and they didn't have, you know, hypercholesterolemia or anything like that, but they still are struggling with this metabolic disorder. You know, that was the one, you know, downer for me. It was like, now they can't even get it. But how do you feel about those medications when it comes to, you know, fertility and PCOS? And of course, I talked about Ozempic babies was some, I remember there was some article about that.
But being overweight doesn't cause you to be infertile. Most patients who are PCOS are also obese and they're infertile because they don't ovulate. One of the pathophysiology behind that is the insulin resistance and high testosterone and estrogen levels. So with Ozempic, when you have that weight lost, your insulin spikes decrease, therefore your testosterone decreases, therefore you start ovulating and hence the Ozempic babies. So when you look at textbook first line of treatment for PCOS, it's actually diet and weight loss. So does it work in everybody? No. But does it work in a PCOS patient? Yes. And I'm sure you can tell with your patients too that not all of them who've lost weight have restored ovulation in regular cycles, right? Because PCOS is multifactorial. So like for me, it wasn't the weight component. It was just my inside, like, metabolic health overall. So even when I was trying to get pregnant and stay pregnant, my doctor would always be like, you know, you don't want to lose weight because you're so lean, but you have this metabolic syndrome that if you actually do control your spikes of your blood sugars, it will prevent you from miscarrying. So it's complicated, not as easy as lose weight, you'll get pregnant. But yes, with Ozempic, it can happen in some patients. And I personally think it's a great drug. I also say it's very new, so you don't know long-term side effects. This is not something that you want to use without adjusting and modifying your eating and your diet and your lifestyle. So you want to do them tandemly. So I think looking at when you intervene with Ozempic and how you maintain that, it's also not safe in pregnancy and it's not safe in fertility. So when you're taking Ozempic and you're trying to pursue fertility treatment, we can't give you anesthesia. So your last injection has to stop 2 weeks before anesthesia. And then there's a 6-week washout period before you actually get pregnant.
Good. Okay. So that's my next questions. All right. Awesome. Well, I mean, you know, as a patient who's kind of gone through all of this, like, you know, you and I have been patients for different things. And so, you know, we have an idea. We're in the medical system. We know how to navigate the healthcare system, right? So I think, you know, for us, it was hard, but it's like, you know, much harder for someone who has no idea how to navigate the healthcare system. And we all know the healthcare system's flawed on so many levels, but how do you, like, what kind of information would you want the listeners to hear about in terms of, you know, the best way to advocate for yourself, the best way to get the help you need, the best way to navigate the system? You know, I hear a lot from when I have patients that come from other fertility centers, not yours, that they feel like they're just like on a mill, like I'm on a mill, you know, and they just, I'm just a number over there. And I think the truth is, you know, some of the big centers do become, you know, sort of like, you know, you're on an algorithm and, you know, it's very algorithmic. And so some people feel detached from the people treating them. So I guess my question is twofold. One is, you know, how do you combat that in your own practice? And number two, like, what advice do you kind of give, you know, the people listening about navigating their own healthcare and how to best advocate for yourself?
I always tell my patients that educate yourself. I know this is really, it's overwhelming to say the least, but really educate yourself. Like, there's all these channels, social media, there's these amazing podcasts like yours, there's resources. So really find yourself that buddy or that group, or really to learn about your body and learn about the questions to ask. So when you sit in front of that doctor, you know the right things. In a perfect world, you shouldn't have to do that, and you wouldn't have to do that. And you really do want to, not to say don't trust your doctor, but really, you know, not have to push. But there's difficult cases. I was talking to somebody yesterday and saying 80% of fertility cases fit in this bread and butter. So that cookie cutter approach is fine. You'll get the baby. But 20% of cases are very difficult where they don't fit in that box. And that's when you really have to be like, okay, wait a minute, let's step back. Like, what do I have to learn? What do I have to ask? What should I be doing? And they don't fit that standard. And I, unfortunately, was in that 20% where it became really frustrating. I also always say never be shy to seek a second opinion. Like, we all as doctors want what's best for you. We want you to get pregnant. We want you to build your family. We want you to learn about your bodies. And you do such a great job of educating and knowing that there's other options out there. I had to seek lots of second opinions before when I had my son. Just, I wanted to know, am I doing the right thing? Is there anything else I'm missing?
And you're a fertility doctor in this. So that's, I mean, so everyone else should be feeling reassured that, like, every one of us, you know, that experience issues within even our own specialty, you know, we've all had to struggle with trying to figure it out, but it's okay to, like, you know, get the help you need to ask the questions and to seek advocacy through, you know, even other people.
100%.
Oh, one other question I was going to ask you, because people ask me this all the time, when they're choosing a center to go to, like, are there statistically things they can look for? You know, oh, this center has a higher rate of, you know, IVF success, or, you know, that kind of thing. Like, is that something that when someone's trying to choose a center and they're like, obviously I refer to you guys, but like there might be some other patients listening who's primary gynecologist or primary care providers, you know, don't, you know, give them, don't have a connected with. So how would they look?
Yeah, there's a SART database that's manned by the CDC that reports SART center outcomes. Most centers have very comparable outcomes because we have access to the same technology. So for me, the biggest thing is success set aside, because most centers have to follow these guidelines. And most centers, we've standardized care so much that most are anywhere from 50 to 70% success based off of euploid embryos, your age, and your health. Really look for such an intimate process. Doctors that you're comfortable with, clinic that you feel comfortable with, that you're not stressed, that moves at your pace, that's answering your questions. Because I think that's the toughest part, not being able to really understand everything that you're going through and kind of blindly following through. Mm-hmm. And success, yes, it's important, but know that most centers have very comparable success.
And then one last thing is, you know, the other thing I get asked about a lot is around egg freezing and do I recommend it? And I, you know, I have my spiel where I talk about, you know, like, your 24-year-old eggs are going to be better than your 39-year-old eggs. Yeah. So, you know, to have it as an insurance policy is what, you know, you should look at it as. But is that kind of how you view it as well?
Or 100%. Yeah. And my, it's not my pet peeve, but it bothers me when patients are like, oh, I did my at-home testing and everything's fine, so I didn't freeze my eggs. And now I'm here at 40. And I want to say, like, nothing trumps fertility, like age. Age dictates fertility, and younger eggs are always better eggs. So if you're even thinking or asking me, should I freeze my eggs? My answer is yes.
Right. And there's so many organizations now that actually like will cover some of those fertility costs for egg freezing because they don't want their, you know, high functioning women to get pregnant.
There's some, yeah.
So whatever it is, but at least they're offering it, you know, as you're climbing the ladder of success in the corporate world or in the field you're in. But yeah, I always advocate for it too. I mean, but I also, you know, you also have to remind people that, you know, egg freezing is an insurance plan. You still want to try it, but you know, live birth rates are variable, right?
Yeah.
And if you could freeze an embryo, it's better than
freezing.
Okay.
You should just do this.
I just want to make sure I'm telling them the right stuff. Okay, awesome. Okay. Do you actually have like rates that you can quote for like for egg freezing, or is it so variable?
Most of the data for egg freezing is for women in their 30s. You need 15 to 20 eggs in your early 30s for an 80% chance of one live birth. When you hit your 40s, you need 40 frozen eggs for one baby. So if you look at most centers, they don't do egg freezing for women over 40 because that means a lot of cycles. And not to say women are committed to do that, but it's hard to swallow, right? To say, hey, you need to do this like X number of times.
Do you want to just quickly walk someone through what it looks like to get egg freezing?
Yeah.
Like just so that
egg freezing is not a bad process. It actually doesn't take months. That's the first question I get. Like, I don't have months to give to this. It's a 10 to 12 day process. So because you're not implanting, it's cycle independent. You can travel short trips throughout it and you just have to take your meds with you, but you can't go out of country or be gone. So you start your injections, for example, today. You come in for monitoring, which is blood work and ultrasound, every third or fourth day. So it's about 5 appointments. And then after 2 weeks, you're done. Your retrieval happens under IV sedation. So you go to sleep. With anesthesia, we do an ultrasound. At the tip of the ultrasound is a needle, and then we suck the eggs out, and then we pass it to the lab. The next day, they'll call you and let you know how many were mature, and we expect about a 70 to 80% maturity. So if we have 10 eggs retrieved, we should expect 8 frozen.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, awesome. Well, that's very helpful, actually. I think those are some of the big questions I always get asked. I'm always like, let me just have you see Dr. Jill.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
So, yeah, but you do amazing work, and I love all the advocacy and education you do on your forum. Please follow her on with Dr. Ruhi Jalani's. I think that's what your Instagram.
Yeah.
But you know, she's always talking all over the world and speaking and researching, and she's doing all the stuff because this is a true passion of hers. I could tell.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and I love working with you.
So we're here to educate, so you could advocate for yourself. So I hope you got some tidbits here. And please join me next time for Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.